As we might say in southern Indiana, Mary Zibist is a serious poet. Like many serious poets, her poems tend to be quiet, but full of echoes and subtle harmonies. The poems in her first book, Granted, echo art, religion, and literature, and she includes in her personal pantheon Diego Rivera, Francis Bacon, Robert Frost, Stevens, Dickinson, and John Donne. For Mary Zibist, a lover of great phrases and wordplay, language itself is an echo, some etymological wave we ride on in our pursuit of understanding our place in the world. And the fun part of the ride may be in hearing things wrong. The last poem in the book, In Tennessee I Found a Firefly, goes, "Flashing in the grass, the mouth of a spider clung to the dark of it. The legs of the spider held the tucked wings close, held the abdomen still in the midst of calling with thrusts of phosphorescent light. When I am tired of being human, I try to remember the two stuck together like burrs. I like to place them central in my mind, where everything else must surround them, must see the burr and barb of them. There is courtship, and there is hunger. I suppose there are grips from which even angels cannot fly, even imagined ones. Luciferin, Luciferase, when I am tired of only touching, I have my mouth to try to tell you what in your arms is not erased." Here we have a poem that begins with Stevens' Jar in Tennessee, evokes Frost's design with its spider holding the tucked wings, acknowledges Donne with its riddling conceit of two lovers and insect life, as in The Flea, and their yearnings for sex and the hereafter. And then finally, she arrives at a place all of her own. As Robert Haas says of her work, Mary Zibist's poems are about the religious and sexual longing, and about suspicion of religious and sexual longing. Mary Zibist creates worlds which don't feel entirely comfortable in the world, whether it includes romantic sexual relationships or mother-daughter relationships. This poet very likely feels more comfortable in the world of the mind and imagination, the world of literature and art, the world of language itself, because, as she points out, being a human can be tiring, and it's often easier and safer to verbalize the world than it is to touch it. It's also cleaner. As Jory Graham smartly summarizes, her work's ambition is the creation of a free human in the midst of the seemingly endless tetherings of desire. That's probably Jory Graham right now. Mary Zibist grew up in Pennsylvania and holds degrees from the University of Virginia and the University of Iowa Writers' Workshop. She is a recipient of an Academy of American Poets Prize and a Rona Jaffe Foundation Writing Award, and her poems have appeared in the Denver Quarterly, the Colorado Review, Seneca Review, and other journals. She is currently a visiting professor of English at Lewis and Clark College in Portland, Oregon, and her first book, Granted, was also a finalist for the 2003 National Book Critics Circle Award. Please welcome Mary Zibist.
Thank you. Thanks for coming. Thank you for having us. This is a wonderful space. What the world is for. Before I started to love you, I tried to love the world. The plump, dumb oranges that crushed in my mouth, the waves that rolled up shore until they were eyelid thin and purple, and the girls who lined up to buy pops in their small, bright suits, the ones who slouched and let their sandy thighs and ankles go unbrushed. Tried to watch them without seeming to watch with an indifference I could wear. Afternoons, they leaned against each other, picking out shapes in the clouds. They weren't girls to throw their hair before them to dry it in the sun. Still, their hair dried in the sun. You could tell it would be a long time before they would be bent down to the kind of love from which they could not right themselves. It was a long time before I saw the slivered moon is no scythe. It is not blade or pool. We cannot see ourselves there. It is only from here that it changes, looks small as a thumbnail, something to offer you, like the blonding shoreline, like myself, as if that is what the world is for. This is called Twelfth Night from the Willow Cabin, and you might remember that the Willow Cabin is mentioned in Twelfth Night when Viola, dressed as Cesario, is wooing Olivia, and finally sort of gives up and says, well, you know, if I were wooing you, here's what I would do. Here's what somebody who really loves you would do. I would build me a willow cabin at your gate and basically plant myself here and make you love me. So this sort of symbol of tenacity. And this is Twelfth Night from the Willow Cabin. Can you see through the window the moth, color of an old handkerchief, flickering up through the dark, as if it would tell us something? It doesn't. I continue to stack the forks neck upon neck until they lie still, they lie right. The moth flutters lower. The cross-eyed cat approaches with its tiny bee-like mouth. How can I say what it is to see it brush you? As it denies me even the smallest affection, I call it Lucy, after the rich woman of Sicily who spooned out each of her eyes, placed them on a platter, and sent it to her suitor as a way of refusing. What separates self from the flutter of longing? They don't fit the way these spoons fit into each other. They are more like knives that won't stack. We do not own ourselves. We do, we know not what, and fear it. Yes, I believe miracles might change me, but I mean conversion from. Oh, sweet burn all over, we do not distinguish thirst from hunger, nor the cat at our feet, temptation from the moth at the window. Oh, sweet burn, I have always wanted this pleasure, this end. Yet, I intend to be gentle. When I was a spoon in my mother's kitchen. But what a luxury to be without hands. Stiff and lazy as all utensils are, with only the back crook of a head and a neck silver and long as an unraveled snail. Not even an eye to watch her rinse another fork and place it neatly beside me. We're clean as the chicken bones in their water. When they simmer, she sits at the piano and begins. I can think so clearly, it's like dreaming. How she would call my name, brush my hair, till we became each other's possession. Her lashes, my cheeks, her brows, my lips. How the melody winds itself down. Her shoulders, my arms, my chest, her waist, each key a representative joy. The range becomes sparser. She picks two C's and trills them. Her thighs, my legs, my ankles, her feet. A two-hand chord blends, deems itself worthy to linger. We would make a beautiful woman. I can think so clearly. Another cadence thinks it is dying, tries to find a pattern, the treble winging itself above the three-note bass line, take me home, take me strong, take me there. The treble wanders, nervous in how it precedes itself, each key an unpried oyster, touched, touched again. I can think so clearly, I think we are two sharp bass tones that do not recur as the bass drops to a single note, obsessive as breath. She is calling me Moonface again. The bass creeps as a slow pattern replaces, pounds itself into, so easily replaces, pounds down an octave, creeps as the treble searches itself out in scales, now softer, now almost not there. This poem is a little bit of a response to Meditation at Lagunitas by Robert Haas, and as I'm sure many of you know, it ends such tenderness those afternoons and evenings, saying blackberry, 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 which I love. But sometimes the celebration of the particular, I get a little impatient with that too. So I'm trying to, I think, have some fun with this in a response. It's called Swamp. A low bleat starts up like a huge swallowing. I lie down in the darkness and listen. He names the purring, starting with alligator, then bullfrog. I take his mouth, flutter, make my high light sounds, so filled with lust for the influential phrase. By day, we canoe the dark water. He points up at the moist branches and says, osprey, egret, swallow-tailed kite. And I watch them eagerly, and I call to them, bird, bird, bird. Approaching elegy. It's hard to believe you are dying, like looking at a Jamesian scene, skipping past happiness to a garden bench beyond the trees. You fill the form of heroine. You sit in your black dress, too tired to imagine the rest of yourself. An old suitor appears, grabs you possibly too forcefully by the wrists. He is still impossibly in love. You disengage your wrists. He leans forward, looks into your eyes, which you close, as if you were all by yourself. He moves closer, talking very fast about happiness. He places his cloak on your shoulders, imagines he'll rescue you. Around you, forms grow darker. House, branch, hydrangea. Above you, freckled expanses of leaves form the beginnings of barbed, lopsided shrouds, a possible solace. If only his kiss could please you, I wouldn't need to imagine past the clean architecture of the story. And perhaps it is wrong to look past that, wrong to ask about happiness. Past midnight, he continues to offer himself. Before, he had offered aimless passion, but now you see it for yourself. He has an idea. He points into the darkness. He is grave, formal. The dark has swallowed the long shadows of the oaks, though not your unhappiness, and it is about to swallow you. Soon, It will no longer be possible. There is just one more page to turn for me to look through your eyes. So I would like to imagine for you something past tragedy. Just as I would like to imagine that we are not in danger, that we have selves more solid than stars, that we are safe in the pages of books we can reopen to look at each other. Except that we are not women formed of words, but of impossible longings. What was it that you wanted besides happiness? You are dying. I have no ideas about happiness and no patience to imagine it possible. Soon, you will not be the heroine. You will not be yourself. And it's not that you've lost the formula. Your form is losing you. Look at how brave you are. I imagined the great point was to be happy as possible with the quick forms that imagine us. But the last time I looked, there you were, distant and bright in the not-so-blue darkness, imagining yourself. I was determined to write at least one sestina I could live with, and that was it. Apology. I didn't mean to say so much to you. I should have thought to let the evening end by looking at the stars subdued into their antique blue and alabaster hues. Such looking would have fit with my intent. I didn't mean to speak that way to you. If I could take it back, I'd take it, undo it, and replace it with the things I meant to give, not what I let slip, it's true, like any pristine star of ornamental hue. I do not always do what I intend. I didn't mean to say so much to you. It slipped before I saw, before I knew. Or do we always do what we intend? Perhaps it's true, and all along I knew what I was saying. But how I wanted you. I should have thought to let the evening end. The placid stars seemed filled and then subdued by what I did and did not want to do. This is called Touch Gallery, and if any of you have been to the Art Institute of Chicago, they have a few sculptures that they've coated in this sort of protective material so that you can actually touch them and interact with them. It was originally created for the blind, and this one is about a sort of bust of Joan of Arc. Good girl Joan, it's okay now. I've removed my rings, my watch, my bracelets. Stone soldier, I'm allowed to touch you here, where the mail covers your throat, your full neck, down to your shoulders, to here, where raised unlatchable buckles mock fasten your plated armor. Nothing peels from you. Your skin gleams like the silver earrings you do not wear. Above you, museum windows gleam October. Above you, high gold leaves flinch in the garden. But the flat, immovable leaves entwined in your hair to crown you go through what my fingers can't. What I want is to go through. What I want is to go through and not around you. I want you to have a mind I can turn in my hands. You have a smoothed and upturned chin, cold cheeks, unbruisable eyes, and hair as grooved as fig skin. It's October, but it's not October behind your ears, which don't hint of dark birds moving overhead or of the blush and canary leaves emptying themselves in slow spasms into shallow hedgerows. Still bride of your own armor, bride of your own blind eyes, this isn't an appeal. If I could, I would let your hair down and make your ears disappear. Your head at my shoulder, my fingers on your lips, as if the cool of your stone curls were the cool of an evening, as if you were about to eat salt from my hands. And I'll read two more. In some sense, a response to William Stafford's poem, Little Girl by the Fence at School. If you don't know what it ends, the grass is talking to the girl, and somebody's just died, and she says, forever, and this grass says, yes, forever, while the sky, it just ends with this repetition of sky. And I like the double motion of that. I like that that repetition at once closes it, like it won't go past that, just sky, 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 nothing further than that. And yet, by repeating that word, especially because it's sky, it makes it feel, I think, sort of endless and open as well as closed. So I tried to pick a moment in which I both very much wanted time to speed up and pass, and which I also simultaneously very much did not want time to be moving. This is called Dear Sky Boy. I'll be 33 for 3 more hours. The soft fruit by the dark, uncurtained window waits, the solid peaches and the stemless pear green apples. By the time you descend from the clear midnight sky, it's over. I'm not your girl. Whatever day I die now, I can't pretend a girl death. Dark rider, the cool rain is coming down invisibly. I can't even hear it tick on the roof, and you are somewhere above it, beyond it, asleep perhaps, and racing toward an ocean you won't reach. Hurry, hurry. Something lifts from me like a veil, and I can't move toward you. Husband, our dead friends are so quiet these moments, and I'm descending towards simple adulthood, so you'll come home to me. And I'll end with this. Knocking or nothing. Knock me or not, the things of this world ring in me, shrill-gorged and shrewish, clicking their charms and their chains and their spouts. Let them. Let the fans whir. All your penitent virgins must have emptied their flimsy pockets, but I was empty enough. I was sweetness and light. I was swollen and soft for the silence I soaked in each night. I had room for every girl's locklet, every last dime and pocket knife. When you put your arms around me for that moment, when you pulled me to you and leaned back, when you lifted me just a few inches, when you shook me hard then, had you ever heard such emptiness? Oh, my outsung, fierce, unthinkable, why rattle only the world you placed in me? Won't you clutter the unkissed idiot stars? They blink and blink like quiet shepherds, like brides about your neck. Call them out of their quietness. Knock them from nothing, from their empty enamel, from the dark that has no way to hold them and no appetite. Call in the dead to touch them. Let them slip on their own chinks of light. Thank you.